wanted to convince myself that I could do it despite being scared. I certainly was scared.
Well, there are times when I, you know, when I was scared, walking across a beam and a gust of wind comes along, then that's.
Mm.
But I liked building bridges because I loved to be a part of something that would have a completion, and I still get a thrill out of passing by bridges or buildings that I that have my handprints on them. And, aesthetically, I guess I like architecture. I like being a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from that, there's a certain prestige in ironworking.
Mm-hmm.
There is a prestige, like the Mohawks have a very high respect and prestige. It's a feeling that you're doing something not just anybody can do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And besides that, the wages are very, very good.
Mm-hmm.
And in that particular kind of employment, there's absolutely no prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're judged on a basis of how good a worker you are, and it's the color of your skin really doesn't have anything to do with it. And so I liked it from that standpoint. And my advancement, of course, in the trade was very good. I rose to be a superintendent of a project.
Mm-hmm.
So I came from being an apprentice to an iron worker to a journeyman, and then I sort of ascended in leadership
mm-hmm.
roles.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't because I'm an Indian. It's because I was very good at what I did, and I was proud of what I did, what I could do.
You mentioned you were in the service twice. Did you enlist again after?
Yes, I enlisted the first time when I was 15 years old, and after 10 months, they discovered I was only 15. So they asked me to leave.
Yeah.
So I went again when I was 19 years old. Then again, that after graduation from high school, I kind of looked around and saw really no opportunities that I wanted. So after talking with my father was a graduate from Carlisle University.
Mm-hmm. That was one of the first
Indian colleges.
Yeah.
I told him that, I said I don't want to drive truck. I said inside of me, there's something else. And he said, well, whatever you want to do, do it well,
mm-hmm.
and you have my blessings. And so I said, well, I'm going to try the service again. And I enlisted again, and there are certain things that I did not have to do that I would ordinarily have to do because of my first enlistment. So I did bypass some of the war kind of training, and I did become a paratrooper, and I like the physical conditioning, the good health, and the comradeship. Again, in the paratroopers, there's a very close comradeship. There's no racial kind of things because everybody is in the same danger, so to speak. You jump out of an airplane at 2,000, 3,000 feet, and whether you're white, black, or brown, they treat you the same. So I did that, and after coming out, I then entered the University of Wisconsin. Of course, one of the primary reasons I went into the service a second time was for the GI benefits.
Mm-hmm.
Ex-servicemen can have their education financed by the federal government in return for your service. So that's primarily why I did that second thing. I've never been in battle. I've never had to shoot anybody. I'm fortunate I was in when there was no conflicts. So, I'm very glad for that because if I had been in, like, say, during the time of Vietnam or Cambodia, I'm sure that I would have turned my back on it and resisted, and I probably would have ended up in prison. That's very likely what I would have done. So then after a year at the university, I decided I didn't want to do that right at that time either. So I did the iron worker thing for 13 years, and then the rest of it is told in the history of the American Indian Movement. While I did enjoy the stint as an iron worker, I found myself in the end almost again being co-opted by that. You know, I almost became a slave to that. To that work ethic, you know, and everybody has to work and everybody has to pay the rent, but I just in the end sort of felt it was tying me down, and I really wasn't helping my people by being an iron worker. I was making very lots of money, but that wasn't really helping the people as I saw it. So when the American Indian Movement came along, the leadership then asked if I would consider coming and working with them, because I do have a very good, sound spiritual background of our religion and our music and our culture, and that is what they were after then. And so I've been with it since.
Well, did you? You said your father went to Kala, huh? Perhaps I don't know enough about Carlisle, but I thought that Carlisle would perhaps be an institution where old Indian traditions would be sort of eradicated.
Yes, they were.
And therefore I'm surprised that you have such a background. Is it through your father or grandfather, or
my father,
how is it preserved?
My father, my mother, my grandfather, grandparents, and our elders.
Mm-hmm.
While what you say is true, nonetheless, my father, like many who went to Carlisle, in spite of that, did retain their identity.
Do you think it was a sort of toughness or resistance that they thought, in spite of that, we will remain Indians?
Yes.
So, in fact, Carlisle, perhaps other institutions like that, have a contrary effect to that, what the planners originally want.
Yeah, a small degree. But I think the majority do get de-Indianized, do get alienated. And that's part of the problem, of course. The two or three generations behind me are guilty of that. And so the result is that a great majority of our Indian youngsters today have no knowledge of their music, their language, don't speak the language, and that's a tragedy.
Mm.
That's part of what we're trying to fulfill too.
Wow. Thanks very much.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be a good idea for school kids here. You've told us that that there is a lot of racism in America, and you've been in Germany for 3 weeks now, and you've traveled around. Did you meet with any racism, and in what form in Germany? How did people react to you? You look Indian, you've got long hair, you certainly don't look like a middle-class white German, and how did people react to you in Germany?
Well, if there has been an expression of racism, it has been on the part of the children more than I felt it from the adult middle age generation.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I experienced almost everywhere is there's a very, very real lack of sensitivity to other groups, in this case especially me. The same stereotype of the Indian seems to exist here, because I walk into a classroom or into a school, and the first thing there is a whole lot of pointing and saying, look at that, and pretty soon out of the voices will come the war whoops, you know.
Mm.
So I always have had to do a sensitivity thing with the children first. And so there seems to be a lack of human relations on the part of the parents and on the part of the schools. There doesn't seem to be anything existing there that would indicate parents do tell their children there are different kinds of people. They speak differently, they look different, but we should respect them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the Indian home, that is one of the first lessons, is respect of mm-hmm. other people. You don't make fun of people because they happen to look different, and you don't carry stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't really ascertain where that comes from, but I'm a strong believer that children reflect what their home is and what their parents teach them or don't teach them.
Mm-hmm. It's partly, as an information, it's partly also from the media, and there's a series of books which used to be very, very, very popular. I think about 60 million issues, copies have been sold by a German writer who'd never been in America, who always wrote about American Indians. And he, Karl May, he formed a certain stereotype. And if you're still here tomorrow afternoon after lunch, a sort of program, film one of his films, would be quite good for you to see that, to see how a stereotype is formed in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Would be quite... maybe that would show it. I thought, but perhaps I'm absolutely wrong, that during the last couple of years, because there have been certain programs on television, films about Wounded Knee, about the St. James Bay Project, where the Cree are losing their land, and, for example, from Survival International, this tour by people like people from the Dene Nation, and also Clyde Belcourt. So I thought that perhaps gradually the attitude towards American Indians is changing, but, well, obviously it's only very much amongst certain people who are interested, and the majority stay the same.
Well, one of the things that I do sense here is while I feel that insensitivity on a part of the younger students, the high school students,
mm-hmm.
I do feel the college age students,
mm-hmm.
there's a much more liberal and accepting attitude on their part.
Mm-hmm.
Never have I heard those same expressions mm. from that sector.
Mm.
In fact, the interaction with the college mm. student has been very good.
Mm. Mm.
You know, they're inquisitive,
mm.
And much more liberal. And in fact, I was with a group last night that, in the main, share the same kind of views as we do about land,
yeah.
about the land, and that part of it seems to be lacking on the older generation and on mm. on the younger mm. kids. Yeah.
This is fairly recent, really, that people are respecting land again, because they see what our progress, in inverted commas, is leading to. You know?
Mm-hmm. I hope it grows. I just really hope it grows, because if we don't do anything about the land, we ain't going to be here to
exactly
to appreciate mm. the land.
There's really no alternative. To stop what is happening now and turn back to make use of the land without destroying it.
It's going to happen quickly. It's going to happen quickly.
Because parts of the process is not reversible anymore. So much is destroyed already.
Well, some of those things is what we as a people would like to share. There's certain things and feelings we have about land and water
mm-hmm.
that are not, to me, should be general knowledge. For instance, we know that it takes water 7 years to circulate through the earth and filter, filter pure again.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at the rate of garbage is being dumped in a sea,
mm-hmm.
and sewage is being poured into rivers, it's not going to have a chance to do that and be pure. And if water becomes worldwide contaminated, what are we going to do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Coca-Cola is not going to—it's not going to do it for us. You know? And the same with, of course, the same is true with land. Indian people, the people of the Southwest, have developed 27 different varieties of corn in dry land farming.
Mm.
That's a development of their own. But they've always maintained that you can't keep on planting corn in the same plot of ground year after year after year. Mm. You have to let the earth rest once in a while. And while fertilizer will force the land to make a yield, pretty soon, you know, all you're going to have is fertilizer. There's not going to be the loam there. There's not going to be the soil there, you know. And, of course, when that happens, then you really...
And that contaminates the rivers again, because the, I don't know what content is rising, and then more plant grows, growth of water plants in the streams.
See, one of the things, too, that is sort of a stereotype, I guess, is that they say that we are nomadic people. We always move from place to place.
Mm-hmm.
They never ask why, though,
mm-hmm.
you know. For instance, our people would place a village at a certain spot, and people could only stay there 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have mm-hmm. to move to let the earth rest,
yeah.
you know.
But, that would be very difficult, of course, to adopt as a system in a country as populated as
mm-hmm.
this. So we must find different ways. But I think I read this in a just normal Sunday paper about 2 or 3 weeks ago, where somebody said it's for the first time that people really begin to understand that we, who always think we are so far advanced and in technology and know everything, that we can learn and must learn, because it's too late, from so-called, what we used to call primitive nations,
yes.
or so, like people from Africa, from America, from in Germany, from the very north, Lapland,
mm-hmm.
because they know how to use the land and how to survive, and it's really a question of survival.
One of the things that's always...
Then say that a survival school, it would be survival in a double sense. Survive from the land, you said.
Right.
You look at plants and survival of culture.
Yeah. One of the things that's always brought up to us in America is that, you know, the West, the move of the people into America and then the settlement and the westward expansion. Their observation was, well, we need the land.
Yeah.
Well, certainly need the land. Take as much as you need. But then whatever you determine is your needs, let that be what your needs are.
Yeah.
But empires are not built that way. And their favorite refrain is that, well, Indians never did anything with the land.
Mm.
And that's true. That is true. We didn't do anything with the land. We never poisoned the rivers. We never exhausted the soil. So it's true.
Exactly,
that's true.
We didn't do anything to the land. Either.
Yeah.
No.
So those are the kinds of things I would like to, you know, share with other peoples, because you know, if we don't have a world consciousness about this earth.
Mm-hmm.
She can be very cruel, and, mm-hmm. and I think she's beginning. She's making preparations for that right
mm-hmm.
now. I can't tell you what will happen,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I just know that you know, either we do it ourselves, or it's going to be done for us.
Yeah.
And when that happens, you know, First National Bank ain't gonna save us.
No.
But the charges that, you know, we are a communist-supported mm-hmm. group, communist-oriented group, that's really a lie, a fabrication. The example, of course, is when we were surrounded by the federal government and the tanks and the armored weapons at Wounded Knee. I didn't see the Communist Party rise up and say, stop it, you know. I didn't see the communists, you know, come running in numbers to be with us. I didn't see them there, you know. I didn't see 1,000 Catholics raise their hand and say, stop it. I didn't see Lutherans. I just didn't see them. I didn't see the so-called freedom fighters or the political ideologists who say that, you know, we should have the liberties. They just weren't there, you know. They were huddled in their living rooms looking at the 6 o'clock news to see if we'd been wiped out yet. That's where they were, you know. And, you know, if the Communist Party really wants to do something, they ought to take the United States to task for waging war on their own citizens, which is exactly what they did. And that's a violation of international law. Mm-hmm. I don't see the Communist Party doing that. You know? Mm-hmm. So, if they are so helpful to us, how are they helpful?
Yeah.
What are they doing? You know? So that just you know, that's just an observation I want to make. You know.
Is there anything you'd like to sort of message you want to get through, or something you would like to say to direct to German school kids?
Not specifically to German school kids.
Or to anybody who may listen to this tape, I think it's.
To people, you know, I'd like to say that we have a saying and a belief that is very simply respect your brother's dream, and that's what we like to give to people. We believe and view life, the world, God, the earth, in this way. And however you believe, or however you view, let that be your view. Don't try to make it my view as well. I respect your dream. Please respect mine. Very simply.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.